I'm a full-time research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Vancouver, Washington. And I normally work on volcanoes most of the time. And the aspect of my work is both in the basic research of how some of these processes work that are active on volcanoes, but I also look on the side of this coin that has to do with hazards and how hazards are perceived by people. And actually, that's what I want to get into today. I guess we can start the tape now. And this is a session on geologic hazards. What are they, and how should we react to them? And I'd like to begin with a story of a volcano in South America, in Colombia, that I had some intimate contact with a few years ago. The volcano is Nevado del Ruiz, and it erupted in 1985. And the activity at this volcano had begun in early the previous year. Well, let's say around January of the year it erupted. It didn't erupt till November of that year, 1985. When activity began, earthquakes began, scientists from not only Colombia, where this volcano was located, but also from many other countries in Europe and the US and other places, flocked there, and over the months, this volcano was monitored, it was wired up with all the latest technological gear. Geologists headed out into the field and started making hazard maps. And so by late summer of that year, I would say, people had a pretty good idea of what the potential risks were to the population. A hazard map, well, there was a small eruption in September, which kind of really should have gotten people really keyed into what was about to happen. And then in October, a geologic risk or a hazard map was published in the local newspapers showing what areas were likely to be affected, and it named the type of processes that would occur and labeled them with bright colors of red as danger zone and orange as the moderately dangerous zones and so on. 2 weeks after that volcano erupted, two weeks after that map was published, the volcano erupted. And the eruption itself was not all that dramatic. It was a fairly small eruption, but what it did is it dumped out a lot of very hot material right on the ice cap of this volcano. And even though it was located only at 4 degrees above the equator, it's in the tropics, it's a very high volcano in the Andes, and so it had a permanent ice cap. It had about 10 square miles of ice and snow up on a fairly flat top. This hot volcanic material melted the ice and snow, a large part of it, very, very quickly. Within 15 minutes, millions and millions of cubic yards of water, liquid water, came rushing down the canyons. Farmers who were up high on the volcano reported hearing just the thunder of these floods coming down. There were radio operators who radioed a warning to the main town below, Armero. In fact, they did it twice and said, "The floods are coming, the mud flows are coming, evacuate." The short of it is, nobody evacuated. The town of Armero, which had 30,000 people in it, was sitting right at the mouth of this canyon, 70 kilometers downstream. They couldn't see the volcano. It was, you know, that far away, and people usually didn't think about it. At 11:30 that night, the mud flows burst out of the canyon with a wall of mud and boulders about 30 feet high, and it spread out and just cut a swath through the center of the town. 23,000 people died. And that was what really kind of opened my eyes to this tremendous gap that we now find ourselves in the scientific community with trying to communicate hazards information to populations that are at risk. And the problem is not only in third world countries. Like, we have just as big a gap in this country. And that was one of the motivating factors for tackling this issue, for this discussion here with us today. So I'd like to open it up to you right now and just ask a question. What are your attitudes toward geologic hazards? And by that I mean there's a whole list of them. Earthquakes, floods, landslides, snow avalanches, and we can include some other natural hazards that aren't strictly geologic, but really fit in the same discussion here, and those would be hurricanes, tornadoes, those sorts of things. How do you personally view them? Are they something that are always out there and happen to other people, or do you think about them when you go out and buy a house somewhere? What do you think?
In Washington, we have volcanoes too.
And we have volcanoes too here, yes.
So I'm fascinated by the one that the cones erupted. I went down to see it. So I'm attracted to it.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't include, like, Hanford as a geologic hazard?
No, that's another whole category of hazards.
Yeah, I mean, because I fear those perhaps more. And Love Canal in Niagara Falls, and those kinds of things, those would be
They're definitely worth thinking about and considering, but I was going to leave them out of the discussion here because they tend to be in the news more when things flare up or there's a minor spill or something. Even they usually get pretty good press, so they're kind of pushed into our consciousness by the media, I think, more than natural hazards tend to be, because natural hazards occur from time to time, and we don't hear about them until usually after the fact. After they've hit, after Hurricane Hugo has wiped out the coast of South Carolina, after Andrew was swept across Florida. But there usually isn't much in the newspapers about hurricane hazards in buying a house, or landslide hazards in buying a house in Seattle. Seattle has a lot of landslide hazards.
You can't take some precautions. You can not buy a floodplain or not buy a geologic fault. You can avoid certain things logically and not be on the edge of a cliff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but everywhere in the world you're exposed in one way or another. I'm from Los Angeles.
But you get less of those.
I mean, I have a couple gallons of water under the sink. Always got some flashlight batteries in the fridge, some Camels, some cat food. But I mean, there's only so much. I mean, I know, should the big one hit, be able to get by if I survive for a couple of days, and then it's going to have to be the National Guard, you know. Mm-hmm. But I mean, anywhere. And I've also seen, I don't know, what's your opinion on the likelihood of a major earthquake hitting? I know, wasn't in the late 1800s there was a tremendous earthquake down in the southern United States?
There was a very large earthquake, probably the largest that ever has hit the United States, in Missouri, of all places.
Yes.
In the early 1800s. And then South Carolina has had two very large earthquakes within about 10 years of each other in the late 1800s.
How do you know they were the largest ever seen? Just the
by the amount of damage that was done, and the extent of damage over very, very large areas.
I guess the Mississippi flooded an area, they say, the size of New Jersey or something like that. But I guess, I mean, I don't know, I was just going to say, what would be a relatively weak earthquake in Los Angeles would be devastating any place else in the country, because earthquakes, I guess, amongst all natural disasters, don't kill people unless you fall into a fissure or something. It's the buildings that kill people in, like, a tornado or a hurricane or a tidal wave.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, the attitude that you just mentioned, I think people's attitude today is that because no matter where you live, there's going to be something that could wipe you out, and also because of insurance. People seem to have the attitude that, well, if I want to live here, I'm going to live here. I don't care if it is on the side of a cliff. And we have been known to have flashes and so on. With insurance, I'll just rebuild, but I want to live here. And I don't know if that's a very good attitude, but it seems to be the attitude of a lot of people.
Yeah, that's my feeling too, that it is a common attitude, that we are barraged by this kind of information. It seems like everywhere there's some hazard or risk to us. And I should perhaps differentiate the way I use those two terms, hazard and risk. Hazard is the physical thing that can hurt us, and the risk is the probability of loss that we expose ourselves to by being there, either visiting, camping overnight in a campground, or building our home there or our business there. And in the science and civil defense community, that's usually the way those two terms are differentiated.
Well, I think on the micro scale, I mean, just thinking about Holden Village here, I've lived through a couple winters here, and there's a winter recreation committee, it's called, that decides when you could go out skiing and how far, because up towards, on the way to Heart Lake, there are a couple major slide areas, avalanche areas. And I'm always mixed. I think one time I was actually on the committee, I'm not sure, but I mean, it's, I really resent having someone control my behavior, because I would like to personally be able to assume risk. When I drive my car, I assume a risk and all that. On the other hand, at Holden, it's so very clear that when you decide to take a risk, you're putting everybody else at risk, because the community would have to rescue you or attempt to rescue you. Or I don't know how, you could never sign enough waivers to say, I'm taking this risk all alone. And so this is a perfect example of how individual and community needs sort of are sometimes clashing. But that for an individual to assume a risk, it's not just that individual, it's other people that are implicated. And that's sort of what insurance does too. You decide to take a risk, but then you want the community to pay if anything happens to you. Like if your house on a floodplain should get hit, then you want help paying for it.
Well, you bring up a good point too, and that is that we culturally as Americans, maybe above all other people in this world, don't like to be told what to do. I mean, we are very individualistic. We like to, we have, you know, if we buy our property, we have rights to use the property the way we want to. And we don't like government or anybody else interfering with our lives.
Well, an issue on any of this is timing. Now, having lived in Los Angeles for 25 years, I mean, you never know when the earthquake's going to hit. That's very random. You know, in your field, volcanologist, I mean, obviously you have some pretty immediate within months and years kind of thing. You know, we happen to be living in the Midwest presently, where tornado warnings. You follow me, and that's within an hour or two. I mean, it's timing is an issue in all this too. And when it comes to geological, I mean, you're dealing with one that, you know, extends over what to you is an instant, is to us 100 years.
Well, a lot of it has to do with our perception, as you say, of the timing of it. You know, how probable is it that one of these bad things is going to happen to me in the next 30 years while I'm living in this particular spot? And that leads right into a concept that I'd like to bring up and discuss a little bit with you, which I think can help us sort out degree of risk from different kinds of phenomena. And that concept is called recurrence interval. Have you ever heard of that?
100-year flood.
100-year flood is a perfect example of what a recurrence interval is. Recurrence interval is the reciprocal, mathematically, of probability. A 100-year flood has a 1 in a 100 chance, or a 1% chance, of occurring in any given year. And so, the other way we say it, it has a 100% chance of occurring in 100 years. It's a 100-year, sometime in 100 years. Let me give you just a little background about how people come up with these, and what the assumptions are that they're based on. If we draw a graph, and I'll use floods here as our example, because that's what we most commonly use these for. On this axis here, I'll put what is called the annual maximum event. And in other words, that is the biggest event, the biggest flood that occurs in any given year.
And that would be in discharge, and usually that would be, say, cubic feet per second. That's the amount of water passing by a point in any given unit of time. On here, on the bottom axis, we will put the recurrence interval. I've already goofed it up here because it's not a straight arithmetic scale. For this kind of analysis, they use a probability scale, which is kind of like a logarithmic scale, and it goes something like this, 1.01 there, 2, 5, 10, 20, 50, 100. So what is happening is it's really compressing the big end of the scale, kind of squashing it in here.
What's that axis labeled?
And this is recurrence interval. These are years. These are years. And this is what we call the recurrence interval, or the inverse of the probability. And this is being the probability scale. So, the way it works out, and just the nature of large events, they tend to follow certain types of distribution, statistical distributions through time. And it turns out that if you use this kind of scale, and then you're plotting the size of the flood here, and we'll say it's 500 or 1,000, and so on going on up, that if you plot these things, first of all, what you have to do is you have to compute the probability of any given event. And let's say we're on the Mississippi River, or at say Railroad Creek. And let's say we have 100 years of record here, that people had been going out and measuring floods on Railroad Creek for 100 years. And the longer you have the record, the better. That makes this a more accurate predictor. And 100 years is a good long record. A lot of streams, for example, a lot of rivers might only have 30 years of record. But let's say it's 100. And you know how big the biggest flood event each year was in those 100 years. Well, the very biggest one in your whole record, we arbitrarily assign as the 100-year flood. We say that was the biggest one to occur within 100 years. Therefore, based on our sample here that we have, and this is just a sample over floods that occurred for thousands of years previously and will occur for 1,000 or more years in advance, but this sample, then, we will assign that as the 100-year flood. And that big flood, when let's say it was 10,000 cubic feet per second, that has a 1 in 100 chance of occurring in any given year. And then by going on down your list in your progressively smaller ones, let's say we take the next biggest flood, it might have only, there are only two. So the next biggest one, would there be only two floods that were as big or bigger? It and the 100-year flood. And so we get to our probability by saying a total of 2 over divided by the number of years, or 1 over 50 is our probability, and so it becomes a 50-year flood. And so you can do that for each of your floods. And you plot them on this graph, and they end up plotting pretty well in a straight line. And so if we go up here then, actually we can continue that line out into the unknown future, but we'll say this is at our 100-year flood here, and it's equal to such and such a discharge. And a 20-year flood would be here, to that discharge. So in the concept, we can do this with any record, any list of maximum events. It could be
size of earthquakes, intensity of earthquakes versus how often they occur, the size of landslides, frequency of landslides, snow avalanches, anything. So recurrence interval is the same basically as probability, and it's a way of thinking about how often events occur over long periods of time on average. It does not mean that for the next 100 years a flood of this magnitude will only occur once. Absolutely does not mean that. It's like flipping pennies. You know, you have a 50-50 chance of getting either heads or tails. And it doesn't guarantee one way or the other. Or like, that's not a good example. If you had 10 black cards and one red card in a 10 card deck, you'd have a 90% chance of getting black on any one draw, but it doesn't guarantee that you won't get the red. And if you shuffle that red back in for your second draw, you could pull it again the very next draw, even though it has a low probability of occurring. There have been examples, for example, in New Zealand in the last decade, they have had 3 100-year floods within a period of 4 years in a basin that I know about.
In that case, if you were to replot your line, you might decide that that was wrong data.
Right.
And that's a little more information.
Exactly right. So these things are made on the basis of the information you have. And if you start getting a lot bigger floods, then you have to redo your plot, and it'll change that. And that size flood will then become a more frequent flood with a higher probability of occurring in any given year. Yeah?
In this semi-logarithmic scale, by averaging out the number of events and plotting, do you always get a straight line, or can you also get a curve? Because what would be the reasons for a straight line and not a semi-logic line?
As I am remembering my background on this, which is a little imperfect, I have to admit, it is based on the statistical distribution of these events in time. They follow a certain type of distribution, a certain type of statistics.
So this is derived from the standard bell curve?
It's not a Gaussian distribution. The bell curve is a Gaussian distribution. This is another, it's like a Pearson log 3 statistical, I forget which one it is exactly, but this kind of probability scale is a way of converting that kind of distribution into a linear space here on that axis, such that this curve then becomes a straight line. If we just did this on an arithmetic scale, we would have a curve that would kind of go off like this, and it would be much flatter out here for the infrequent events. But by compressing it this way, it forces it to be a straight line. And so we can, if we want to know what the 500-year flood is, then on this scale it might be about here for 500 years. We would just go up and then read across to see how big the 500-year flood would be. It's not a perfect predictor. You can see that it has some severe limitations. But right now that's the best we have for predicting how big floods will be.
Because mankind changed it. If nature was just out there all by itself and you didn't build roads and pave parking lots, because we modify the natural environment by building stuff.
We sure do.
And so that's going to screw up long-term
records. We sure do.
100 years ago there was just a screwing path. Now we have.
That's a very good point. And in fact, if we had done this for a watershed that was in its natural condition, and then in the next 10 years after that, this recurrence interval was determined, developers went in and let's say 30 or 40% of the basin was turned into streets and parking lots.
It's different.
It would be totally different. The runoff would be so much faster in the upper watershed from that, and the flood characteristics would be so much different. Likewise, if the Corps of Engineers came in and started dredging out the channel, making it deeper, it would change it in the other way. It would be able to handle bigger floods that would not flood out of the banks.
Then they build dikes, though. They forced all the water into the narrow dike that used to be out in the big plain. Mm-hmm.
And that does it, too.
I mean, the events that are much farther away from our control, like the Peruvian El Nino and the Amazon deforestation, that all have effect on the rainfall.
Mm-hmm. That would be a much more long-term effect. That's true. Yeah. So, and actually, that was my next point on this. These things will change if conditions change. And so, for them to be accurate, they have to be constantly updated by the hydrologists or by the whatever the experts are that kind of keep track of the particular type of event.
Yeah, but that also means that you have less and less data for predictions. The more you update those external impacts, the less data you have on the actual flood itself.
Well, you'd be starting with a new database that would have relatively few points. That's
right. You have less and less ability to predict.
That's right.
Less reliability.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, the numbers for the probability of occurrence or recurrence interval are out there. They're available for lots of different things. For hurricanes, for example, on the east coast of the U.S., recurrence interval is about 1 in 30 years for a major hurricane. Once in 30 years. 30-year recurrence interval. The recurrence interval on the Mississippi River for floods has been changing, for the same reasons you're saying, of all the dikes that have been built. And actually, that would be a good plug for this book that I ordered from the bookstore, The Control of Nature by John McPhee, is a really interesting look at man's dealing with natural phenomena that are hazards, and how we try to control them, and how we are constantly running up against problems, difficulties in exerting the control we would like to have. And he treats this whole concept of changing conditions and recurrence interval and risk, he treats very well in a very kind of narrative way. There are three main chapters in here. One's on floods on the Mississippi. One is on stopping lava flows in Iceland by squirting seawater on them. And the third is about the debris flows or mud flows that occur in the Los Angeles area. Really interesting read.
Who is John?
John McPhee is a journalist and writer. He's based at Princeton University at the moment. He's primarily a writer for the New Yorker magazine. But he's written a number of books based on geology. He seems to be fascinated by geology and geologists, and has written quite a few.
It's one about the railroad that includes the Railroad Creek Valley to up at Lyman Lake, encounters with the Archdruid. He and David Brown,
oh,
and somebody else. Yeah, it takes place at Lyman Lake, one of the conversations.
Oh, really? Didn't know that.
What's the title?
The title is The Control of Nature. And there are some copies over in the bookstore. And also, if I'm talking about books, I should mention for some of the other talks, this is a relatively recent text, general geology text, which I borrowed from a colleague at the office just to, you know, give me the facts and figures I needed for putting together these talks that within grasp here. And I've been reading through it, and it's really a very, very good book. It's extremely well written, quite readable. It's called The Dynamic Earth: An Introduction to Physical Geology, and it's by Brian Skinner and Steve Porter. And Steve Porter is a professor at the University of Washington. Okay. Now that we've sort of talked about this a little bit, let me move on to the ways we think about doing something about natural hazards. And
the word we use generally is mitigation, hazard mitigation. About this, I kind of visualize, I'll draw a little cartoon here. Let's say we have the hazard, and it exerts or has the potential for exerting its destructive power in some way on a population. There are basically two approaches to dealing with that. And the first I call active mitigation, and that's either doing something directly to the hazard or doing something directly to the population in order to prevent bad consequences. Now, in most hazards, landslides, snow avalanches, hurricanes, tornadoes, tsunamis, which are tidal waves, this sort of thing, there isn't a whole lot we can usually do about the hazard itself. So, really, that an active mitigation comes down to dealing with the people. And the thing actively we can do in this case is get out of the way. And there are sort of two timescales at which we can do that. We can go ahead living there, and then we can say, well, when the hazard occurs, we will evacuate in time to save the lives. And a lot of people in many parts of the world do it that way. Particularly in Asia, where arable land, where population densities are high and arable land is at a premium, people live in some very hazardous areas. Lots of people live in very hazardous areas. And they have strong ties to the land, particularly in cultures like that where they have great respect for ancestors and the fact that their fathers and their father's fathers lived in these areas. If you try to relocate these people, they don't want to relocate. They want to live there. So they're forced to deal with this aspect of having some sort of an evacuation at the critical time. And what is required for that is some sort of warning system. You have to be able to know when the hazard is occurring, when the landslide is occurring, when the volcano is erupting, and it has to be reliable. Another requirement is that you have to have ways of getting people out of harm's way quickly enough. You have to have, if means of transportation are required, you have to figure those out ahead of time. You have to have, if you're going to rely on cars, for example, you have to have enough roads that if everybody's going to try to leave town at once, you're going to have to handle a lot of cars. Some examples of this, there's an island in Kagoshima Bay in southern Japan that is a volcano. It actually is connected, it's now an isthmus because one of the recent lava flows connected it with the mainland. So there's one narrow two-lane road that connects it to the mainland. But 8,000 people live on this island and on this isthmus. And the volcano has been erupting continuously since 1955. But every once in a while, it really decides to let loose with a big one, and they need to get everybody off the island. So they have a plan where all the ferry boats in this whole bay, and there's a big city right next door, Kagoshima, and so ferry boats and barges and other commercial boats have been incorporated into this plan. And when a certain government authority gives the signal, all the boats converge on particular harbors. And everybody on that isthmus knows exactly which harbor they're supposed to go to, which dock. They all line up,
and they can evacuate 8,000 people in 4 hours. And they drill, they practice that every year. And that brings up the point, if you're going to rely on evacuation, it has to, you have to have a plan, and it has to be rehearsed if it's going to work. Otherwise, you get into trouble. The city of Honolulu has, or had a plan back in the 60s for evacuation of low-lying areas in case of tsunamis or tidal waves. Well, they got a tsunami warning, and although they had a plan, the plan hadn't been thought through quite well enough because the warning came in the middle of the day. And here's, and sociology plays a big part in this too, you might figure. They figured everybody would go to high ground like they were supposed to, and there were maps available, you know, which streets to take to high ground and get out of the way. Well, it occurred when school was in session and everybody's kids were in school. Well, the parents weren't going to go to high ground before they went to get their kids. So everybody started converging on these schools, and there was just total gridlock. And it turned out that it was a false alarm, that the tsunami never came. But had it come, a lot of people would have lost their lives. Another thing is you have to have a safe place to go to. You have to have a refuge, a safe refuge that can be reached in time. Now, at Mount Rainier, very close here, Mount Rainier is a volcano that is particularly dangerous because it's very, very high. The rock is very, very weak because over the centuries and millennia, the gases and fluids coming up through the mountain have changed the once hard rock to soft and weak clay. So it's structurally very unsound. It's got a lot of ice and snow. There's more ice and snow on Mount Rainier than in all the other Cascade volcanoes put together. And it's in an earthquake zone. Now, and we know from geologic studies that in the past, both from non-volcanic events, we assume earthquakes, and volcanic eruptions, about 6 or 7 times in the last 10,000 years, big chunks of Mount Rainier have come sliding off. They turn into these debris flows or mud flows, and then they flow as much as 100 miles down out on the, into the Puget Lowlands. And so, for example, there's a town of Ording, which is west of Mount Rainier, but it's fairly close. And that town is now starting, you know, they're starting to take this hazard seriously, particularly since in the Northwest here we've learned that earthquakes are a little bit more frequent and sometimes bigger than people had thought they might be. So they're starting to worry about that, but they have a big problem in that if one of these big slides comes off Mount Rainier, they probably only have about 20 minutes to do something about it. So that presents some big questions about, well, what kind of a warning system do you use? How do you inform people quickly enough? And do we have safe places to go to that are close enough? And another big problem with evacuations is that political officials are very reluctant to order evacuations. And this has been borne out in many case histories in this country and other countries, and that is they are expensive. And if nothing happens, they think, well, I'm stuck here with egg on my face. I've spent all this money, we've moved everybody and disrupted everybody, and nothing happened, and it's going to be an embarrassment to me. And so that's one other thing to keep in mind, and I think that was one of the main reasons for the failure of evacuation in Nevado del Ruiz when so many people died. Okay, another aspect of it is that we can, rather than wait to the last minute, we can try to move people out well in advance, and we call that land use planning, you know, zoning, hazard zoning, that sets up zones that says people can't build here. Given an area that is a virgin landscape to start with, it might be easier to do, but in most cases these hazards are recognized in places where people already are living. So again, there's a big political and economic factor that prevents that. People, and sociologic factors, people don't want to move, and second of all, it's politically very difficult and very expensive to buy people out and say, you know, leave your home behind and we'll relocate you somewhere else. It also requires that the hazard be well enough understood and the zones be drawn out on maps so people know where the hazardous areas are and where it's safe to live. And in large part, that has been done in many, particularly in this country, that we have hazard maps for most floodplains, for most of the volcanoes in the Cascades, and so on. It's easier with something like a volcano, which is a kind of a point source of hazard, versus an earthquake, which can occur over a very broad area. And in that case, you really don't have anywhere you can go easily. You just have to be prepared to ride it out in a safe way. Okay, the other general approach to dealing with hazards, natural hazards, is a more passive approach in the sense that the people will stay put, or at least they think they will, and what you do is you insert something kind of in between the people and the hazard. You build some sort of a structure, or you say, you write new building codes and you say that the buildings have to be built to such and such a standard so that when the earthquake comes or the flood comes or whatever, the people will be protected because we've engineered it. And this is one of the main points that John McPhee brought it up. The biggest problem with this approach is that the structure, the codes, whatever it is that we think we can engineer to protect the people always has a design for an event of a particular size. Most river structures are designed for the 100-year flood. Earthquake engineering standards are designed for an earthquake of a certain magnitude. I don't know what it is down in California, but there is some magnitude for which it's designed. The thing is that you can always get an event that's bigger than the design event. And so the people that are living down here have a problem. They tend to think that they're safe. People that live behind the levees along the Mississippi River, they see all these big structures. They think, well, we're protected. You live in an earthquake engineered building, you think you're safe. They can always be exceeded. But granted, the probability of a big enough event coming along is fairly small. It's a fairly small probability in any given year. So people, ideally, should have the choice in assessing what the risk is to them and deciding whether it's a small enough risk to accept and go ahead and live there, or to decide it's not, they don't want to accept the risk and move. And the biggest problem we find now is, as we're working with people and telling them about hazards, is that most people don't know what the risk is. They don't understand the process, they don't know what the probabilities are involved, and so they don't have a basis for making that kind of informed decision. So if we have levees and dikes and these kinds of structures, the easiest thing to do is people look around and say, well, all these houses and shopping centers are here, gosh, it must be safe. Look at all the things the Corps of Engineers has done. And that's about as far as the sort of analysis that people go through is. And there's this false sense of security can be developed. Secondly, once that's done, very often there are inadequate plans laid by civil defense and government officials for dealing with what happens if the big event comes and overtops the levees, the landslide bursts through, whatever. And what do we do then? How do we, can we evacuate people in time? Are there secondary protective measures that we can take? And often that's not the case. So, I guess I'm going through this for the purpose of raising some questions in your own minds about these issues. And to try to drive home the point that there is risk everywhere, as someone said right at the beginning. Like there's hardly anywhere in this country where there aren't some risks from natural hazards of some kind. But as informed citizens and homeowners, we really need to be evaluating those risks and making informed decisions. And in most cases, the people that are hurt by these events are people who built their homes in places and never questioned the hazards or the risks or the risk presented by the hazards that existed there. I can think of an example. There's a housing development in a little town adjacent to San Francisco that's in the hills just to the southwest. They have a lot of debris flows there. These are like these mud flows with lots of boulders and things, and they're often triggered by heavy rain. These things have preferential flow paths. They tend to go down these little gullies and canyons. And if your house is built at the mouth of one of these things, you're in a bad spot. But most people who build there haven't even heard of these events before, let alone worried about them. A storm a few years ago, one of these came down and hit two houses, and then three children were crushed to death in the bedrooms as they slept. And I'm sure the parents, you know, never would have lived there if they'd known this was a possibility of occurring.
Are you sure? That's the question.
Yeah.
Is whether people trade off a beautiful location and land in an expensive area, but I mean, for what probability should a person consider not living somewhere?
Yeah. I don't know. I can't answer that for people. I don't know. Do you think there are other factors at play here?
Well, I know in the Midwest, for example, poorer people are willing to live on the floodplain because that's the only... I mean, I know, for example, a young family struggling and they, you know, struggling to make it financially, and a housing development opened up on the floodplain. It's obvious it's the floodplain, and they knew it was the floodplain. They didn't know the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Or you think 100-year flood, fine. I'm already 30 years old, won't happen in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And they could get a house for under $100,000 there, and it was the only place they could.
Yeah.
But in the Johnson flood, it was the other way. It was the poor people that lived on the hill and the rich people that lived on the city.
And it doesn't always affect the poor people. The Oakland Hills fire a few years ago raced through and burned, a wildfire that burned 2,000 homes. And I'll bet you not a single one of those homes cost less than $500,000. And I also would wager that most of those people never thought of the possibility of wildfire because they were in a city.
The roads were so bad. They were like single roads. They live up in the hills and there was no way they could get out.
That's part of the idea
of the flanges.
Keep people out who don't know how to get up there.
Yeah. But here was something, wildfire, which is a natural hazard that occurs with a certain frequency. We know what that frequency is. Foresters can go out and core trees, and you can find fire scars at different levels within living trees where the fire comes through and it burns and leaves a mark. Fire frequencies are quite well known in some areas, and yet that's not a factor in most people buying a home on the outskirts of almost any town in California or anywhere in the dry western U.S. And yet, wildfire is a big hazard in those kinds of locations.
It seems like if you want to do it the American way and not control behavior, you almost have to do it with financial incentives. Policymakers refuse to insure things that are built in unwise areas. And we have, I live on the East Coast right now, and we have, I think it's federal flood insurance that keeps compensating people when their houses are flooded, which happens every 10 years with different hurricanes or tidal waves and things. And the people know that they can keep getting the federal government to compensate for the damage that happens. And so there's no incentive to, or there's no disincentive to keep people from getting areas. And I'm sure the people who got their homes destroyed by wildfire got full compensation for them as well from insurance companies.
Behind it.
Yeah, part of your model is based on the fact that the science is sound to start with before you can come up with the mitigation. And I'm thinking of an example in Seattle. It turns out that the after places like the Columbia Tower were built, further investigation showed that it's on a fault zone. Right? So what do you do about remediation when you get a skyscraper that you suddenly later on couldn't have been prevented, wasn't known at the time. It's certainly not a perfect model in terms of the a priori science either. So think about that.
The previous comment there really raises a point that I was going to sort of throw out at you to as a teaser question. Are we doing people a favor, do you think, by providing federal disaster assistance in some of these areas?
Who pays for it?
And who pays for it? We do, right.
Well, that's a big controversy on the Outer Banks of the Carolinas. I mean, people that have been there and you say, I own this land and I'm not going to move. But they're going to be flooded again and we're all going to pay them for it.
Yep. In one of the suburbs of Charleston, they passed some new zoning regulations saying that people couldn't build within so many hundred feet of the shoreline. And this was right after Hurricane Hugo, when all those houses were leveled to start with. And people refused to accept that, and they voted the town council out, put a new town council in, changed the law, and rebuilt them.
That's the American way.
What are some good sources if you're a potential homeowner to find this sort of information? You know, the university or just...
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no really good place you can go to. Most communities now have some, or states would have some sort of emergency management agency, civil defense. And you can go there. State of Washington has emergency management agency. Local universities would be a good place to check too, but it's going to take some footwork probably at this stage, because there is no single one place you can go to get all the information.
Or insurance,
but it's out there.
Yeah, or insurance companies. They're
not gonna. Yeah, I don't know about insurance companies if that's necessarily, because they might not be all that well informed either. Yeah.
Didn't the insurance companies, they didn't want to insure any mobile homes in Florida anymore after the last Hurricane Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
At least the majority of them didn't want to.
And that might be the kind of financial disincentive that is required to get people to stop living in mobile homes in tornado, hurricane-prone areas.
Yeah.
Going back to discussion on the low area, low income housing, we had that. I live on the Mississippi, but I'm above what's going on, above the flood level. But I'm not close to it because St. Paul has had closed arterial streets and their airport was completely covered. So we are close to it. But they had a housing where people live privately called Lilydale, right on the banks of the Minnesota, where it comes in with the Mississippi. It was for years and years, those people refused to move, although they got flooded almost every year. But it was low-cost housing, and they stayed there. Some on the land, of course, get affected. Some actually live in households, and they don't care because they go, you know. But they finally have taken the permanent residence out of there. They legislated it out of there, so they don't have that constant thing. But it's true that low-cost housing is in those places that are prone to that. Mm-hmm. But people will live with it.
And I guess I believe personally that if people want to accept the risk and live there, and have in their own mind some plan to deal with it, that should be their right. But, and I'm not sure we should bail everybody out financially if they proceed to do that.
There's going to be Mr. McPhee is probably going to be able to write another whole book about the Mississippi, because now, I mean, everybody, everything is coming together against the Corps of Engineers and everything else, because now it's proven that one of the destructive effects is that where they have channeled the water, instead of letting it spread out now, where they have channeled it, the force has become great, and the force has done more destruction than the spreading.
Mm-hmm.
So, for years to come, there will be a lot of controversy about that.
Can we ask you, as a scientist, what would you like to see the policy be in terms of the amount of control that you put over the risks that people can assume? Or which ones do you focus on?
Well, my personal preference, I guess, would be mostly for education, to try to get the general public more aware of the natural hazards and what the risks are involved with those natural hazards. And secondly, I think governments have a role in having some fairly strict land use planning and zonation that keeps people out of the most dangerous kinds of areas. Because I think that's a government's function, to prevent loss of life, even if people are belligerent and say, they want to go ahead anyway. The really dangerous places, I think, should be exclusionary.
So we map the county or the state, say this is low, medium, high, and you can't live in high, but you can live in medium and low if you know it.
And that's done in some places.
Yeah.
There's always the trade-off. Property, somebody's going to lose. Property values will go down in those areas. People who own the property won't be able to sell it because it won't be of any use to anybody else other than perhaps a greenway. It's going to be expensive for communities to buy up property in these zones to make them green belts. But it can be done. It can be done if people want to make it happen.
So many cases they cannot afford tax losses by not allowing the house to be built or stopping the house from happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're not easy questions. Yeah.
I mean, also since the phrase was used about the American way of life, that we are a republic and that every one of us is involved through our taxes in compensating these people in these disasters. But so often we don't really get involved in the functions of government. There's a real incentive for those who are developers and realtors to have themselves appointed to things like county development commissions and so forth. And as a result then, sometimes there's a great appearance of a conspiracy between government and those who would benefit by the sale or occupancy of these lands.
That's a very good point.
Something I think we're lacking too is not on the proportion of a catastrophe, a short-term catastrophe or anything like that, but long-range insidious things that happen in our community. And we talk about land use planning and that sort of thing. But in communities where suburban sprawl is taking place, and it was mentioned a little while ago, the first thing you've paid everything in sight, you've built buildings there, you've got runoff which which has changed the flow of the water getting off the land. It's not going into the land or into the earth. Our water levels are dropping. We've cut all the trees, and so the oxygen isn't being replaced into our atmosphere. And these are things that are generally being ignored by our city fathers, by our land use planners, and that sort of thing. And there's no thought given to that. And the first thing we know, we're going to be in serious problem by not taking attention to that.
Yeah, that's right. We have a whole host of problems that we're bringing upon ourselves.
What's the answer?
I think it has to be done in moderation. There has to be some thought given to, certainly there's trade-offs that have to be traded off. But what I see too much, I go to the city planning or the county planning and so forth, and they're just, if you mention anything about water runoff or cutting down trees or anything like that, it's just kind of laughed out of the courtroom.
Well, the farmers in Minnesota were told, in southern Minnesota, were now, they've been flooded out since April. Their fields have covered. They were told by way back by the Reagan administration, Russians had started, get out there, fellas, and plow to the fence posts. You know, raise as much crops as you can to feed the world. And now those fields are covered with water. Mm-hmm. So we have legislators legislating economics and stuff that never went Econ 101. Mm-hmm. The problem is not that we haven't had floods in Minnesota that drained the southern part and western part of the state. The problem was that this year it began raining. It began raining in April and it never quit.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there are any easy answers, and I guess I'll just stop here and kind of leave it with you. And I guess my feeling is that the answer lies with each of us and the rest of the people in this country, that we need to take an active part in understanding what the situation is. We need to understand the consequences of what we do when we cut down forests and when we pollute our groundwater and things like that. And we have to be active in our governments, our local governments, our state governments, not leave it to, like you say, it is really true. It's the lawyers and the land use plan, or the lawyers and the developers who are on most of these county planning boards, who have a real vested interest in continuing the way things are going. So I guess we'll stop there and be happy to talk to anybody who wants to stick around.
Thank you.